Hey, everyone. My name is Leela Sinha, host of Power Pivot, the podcast. I'm a Unitarian Universalist minister, an executive coach, and the founder of the Intensives Institute. We all know that power can corrupt, but I believe it doesn't have to be that way. It is possible to use your power for good. But where is that power? What is a better world? How do we move from imagination to possibility to reality? And concretely, how do we as business owners build ethical structures into the very foundations of our institutions and our businesses? Join me on Power Pivot, where we explore business, leadership, ethics, community, and how it all fits together. There's passion, compassion, and not infrequently, a bit of spoken word. Find us at intensivesinstitute.com or subscribe at Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and elsewhere. And please leave us a review and tell your friends and your boss about Power Pivot. Let's use our businesses to make the world a better place together.
This podcast involves topics including, but not limited to, sex, violence, and mental illness. As these are difficult subjects for many, listener discretion is advised. If you feel these topics may disturb you, it is okay to reconsider listening. Privacy and confidentiality have been and always will be protected as personal information has been removed whenever possible. Should you ever feel unsafe or suicidal, please contact your local crisis center, emergency services, or the national hotline. For U.S. residents, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. You matter.
Hey, this is Kate. It's been a whole lot of year. Like, just starting from I don't even know when. It's been a lot of year. And so many, many deep apologies for all of my guests for how long it has taken. But I'm working on getting back to my own thing again. And today, my guest, her name is Sharon LaBelle, and she's a philosopher by trade, which is a challenge for me because thinking about thinking is not a thing that I do by nature, but it's a thing that I do when I have to, when it's important. And I think most of the time it is important to think about how and why it is that we do the things that we do, and how and why our brains function the way that they are. And just how and why, you know, just how and why we are the way that we are. Are you sure you really want to know? This is Ignorance Was Bliss.
My name is Sharon LaBelle. I guess you'd call me an independent philosopher. I've been writing and speaking about philosophical topics my whole adult life. And though I have an academic background in philosophy and comparative religion, I consider it a mission to rescue philosophy from philosophers and to rescue virtue from the sanctimonious and to rescue art from critics. I try to make abstruse philosophical ideas available to regular people so they can immediately apply them in their own life as a way to cope with adversity or as an aid to moving in the direction of living the best possible life. I'm probably best known for, I've written a number of books, but the one that I'm associated with is, it's called The Art of Living, the classical manual on virtue, happiness, and effectiveness. And what it is a modern interpretation of the teachings of an ancient Stoic philosopher called Epictetus. Now, I wrote this book, it seems like it was back in the Stone Age, but it was actually the early 90s. And this was a time when, what would you say, the zeitgeist, or at least my world, the people I knew, were eschewing dead white men and their ideas, and instead were magnetized by especially Eastern thought, Taoism, Buddhism, and then their sort of modern corollaries like mindfulness. So I read the works of Epictetus at the time, and I was actually very excited about his ideas, which actually seemed to me to dovetail with many Eastern teachings. And I think that's why I was so comfortable with his ideas. He looks at the world essentially through a moral lens. Anyhow, this is all to say that no one had heard of Epictetus in those days. No one, I couldn't even pronounce his name in those days. And now, fast forward to today, there's this vibrant modern Stoicism movement, which I became a kind of just by accident, a mouthpiece in a way for modern Stoicism. This was unsought, but because of the success of this book, The Art of Living, it's just followed me around everywhere. And I'm not unhappy about that, but I do need to say straight out that I don't consider myself to be a Stoic. I don't like being affiliated with any isms, because I think they can easily elide into, they can become kind of culty with cults of personality. And then as soon as that happens, then there's always some guy at the top who can't keep his penis in his pants. You know, it just, you know, we see it over and over.
That's
and
exactly over. Where the path goes. It's so true.
Yeah, right. You know, someone should make the flow chart. Anyway, I don't mean to sound cynical, but I'm interested, as I was then, as I am now, with very basic, accessible lives for improving the quality of the choices we make, growing our character, and augmenting our commitment to, for lack of a better way to say it, to this moment, to making this moment count, because life is amazing if we slow down to the speed of life and pay attention and dare to care. Dare to care. So anyway, that's who I am. Oh, there's one other piece of me, which is, it's important to me. I'm a performing musician and composer on it's a one-of-a-kind instrument that is derived from a hammer dulcimer and a cymbalom. It has 106 strings, and I had a guy build it for me, and I hit the strings with mallets, and it creates a kind of holy sound, you know, regardless of whether you're religious or not. It sometimes just makes people cry in a good way. So I actually use what I call the thing, this instrument, with my philosophical discussions. And I use it not least because even though I've just spoken at great length here, I often feel tongue-tied and feel that words are in sort of an insufficient language for expressing important meanings. So I like to revert to music as a language sometimes to say what needs to be said.
So I have at least three simultaneous responses, which I do. I'm going to stutter for a couple minutes because that's also what I do. One is, let's start with the most recent. Do you read music or do you play in the moment but through impulse or through instinct?
That's a lovely question. I do both because I do and I can read music when I'm playing in ensembles. But I feel most at home in the world when it's just me and the instrument. And what comes out could be improvisational, or it might be a medley of tunes from, you know, the mental file cabinet. No, it's not a mental file cabinet. It's a file cabinet in the heart, although I don't think hearts are that orderly. And tunes arrive, and I have to give them life.
Okay, if it was me, I would also once in a while get drunk and play show tunes or 90s rock or something.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, good.
I love that you said that. Yeah, you should hear acid rock on a hammer dulcimer kind of thing.
I absolutely should. I've played a hammer dulcimer before, so
oh,
I have a sense.
You. Oh,
I
so have. You know what we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. A lot of strings that all want to go out of tune.
Yeah. And, you know, and I'm hard of hearing now. I wasn't in high school, and so I used to play percussion instruments and percussive instruments, and that included a hammer dulcimer for a little while. And it's a beautiful sound. It can, but boy, you get a little bit out of tune and it's extraordinarily not beautiful very suddenly. But playing Stairway to Heaven on a hammer dulcimer gets people's attention.
I'm thrilled that you know that you have some familiarity with the instrument from which this thing is derived, because normally I have to give a long spiel about what it is.
I know a little bit about a lot of things. So yeah, and that's, I couldn't effectively do it now, but it was funny, maybe 2 years ago, approximately, it was during pandemic, two of my kids were in band. And playing from home, which meant we played what we had at home. And what we had at home was a trumpet, which absolutely not. That's not going to happen in a house with six people locked down. Thank you. And so we have also a Glockenspiel small bell set.
Yes.
And a drum pad. And those I can send you down to the basement and I can't hear it from my bedroom. And so we're good. And my now 12-year-old asked me, he's like, do you used to play this, right? And I'm like, yeah, that's what I hear. People tell me that. And he's like, play me, you know, I need a warm up. I need a warm up exercise of some sort. And I was in the marching band through high school and early part of college. And I was like, well, I think I remember. And it turns out I don't remember if I'm looking at it, but if I'm just doing the thing, then I can still play the warm up exercise. I can hear it right now. I don't know if you can hear it right now, but I can hear it right now as I'm picturing the instrument. And it's just funny that it's been a hot minute since I've been in high school, and I have profound memory issues, but I can remember that.
Isn't that something? Yeah. Music, so, how it gets in your bones.
It just does. It really does. And, you know, and I've had both the experience of music being stuck and what's the lasting, long lasting in some form. And then I've also had a period of time I had a personal loss in my life in 2019, and I went about 6 months, maybe a year, where I couldn't listen to music. I couldn't cope because I never knew what was going to trigger an emotional reaction.
Oh, I see.
And I wasn't willing to risk losing one of my comfort songs to grief. So I was more comfortable putting all of the songs on the back burner, set aside. I'll listen to them later when it doesn't hurt so much, because I don't want to associate music with the way that I'm feeling right now.
What you're saying is very interesting to me, because although music is one of the top important experiences in my life, I can seldom listen to music because it kind of hurts too much, or it by perhaps being too beautiful or too true or too cacophonous, or but what you said seems very true to me, the idea that it is so emotionally evocative that it can almost kill us. It's dangerous. It's dangerous. It's beautiful. And I mean, the subtext here isn't, okay, everybody, stop listening to music. Wrong. It's not that, but it's a testament to the power of music.
Well, and I think that listening to music can often be an act of self-care. Like we talk about self-care like it's eating chocolate and taking a hot bath. Self-care is sometimes literally getting out of bed. It is sometimes not answering the phone. It is sometimes listening to music, and it is sometimes not listening to music.
Right.
And I had taken so much comfort from music, both, you know, more often for me, lyricized music rather than instrumental only. Like I like to have words with it. It fits in my brain better. But both, depending on where I'm at in the moment. And there are times where I'll hear a song that I haven't heard in years, 3, 4, 5, 10 years. And I'll hear the song again, and I know exactly where I was, exactly what I was eating, what I was wearing, who I was with, and what my mood was at the time.
Yeah.
And when I was in this incredibly complicated, deep grief of 2019, everything sucked all the time. And I didn't want to associate anything, any of my comforts, with that time. So I didn't wear my favorite sweatshirts for several months, and I didn't listen to the music that normally I would turn to as comfort. And I have certain authors that are like mental floss for me. There's no challenge to the read. There's no, you know, I'm not thinking here. It's just comfort read. And I avoided them. And all of it in the moment, I couldn't figure out why. Like, why in this moment that I'm feeling awful and want comfort and have no, like, I never feel okay. Why am I avoiding these things that 6 months ago would have felt okay? And I finally realized it's because I am afraid that I will lose them forever, because I could listen. Like, there was one, there's one song in particular, and it's not even a song I especially liked or felt strongly about. It just happened to be playing. So the loss that I experienced was to suicide, and I was driving to inform the decedent's friends because I didn't have any of their contact information, but they met weekly for lunch. And so I'm showing up in their place to deliver some really awful news. And I know it, and I don't wanna, but I don't wanna is a lot of adulting, you know? So fine, you do the right thing because you do the right thing. And as I'm driving in, there's a song by The Offspring, of all bands, called Gone Away. And it's about death. And I'd never realized it was about death. I'd never thought, like, I knew the words, but I'd never quite assigned meaning to the words, because it's The Offspring. It's punk. It's loud. It's just sort of, there's an aggression in letting it out, and you're not really leaning into the, I'm not really leaning into the meaning of the words. I'm just singing along to the words. But in that moment, I can picture where I was, in what vehicle I was driving, and what I was wearing. And I still to this day, it's not that I can't listen to the song anymore, like, it doesn't upset me anymore. It's just not pleasant anymore. I don't want to listen to that song. And there are still other Offspring songs that I'm fine with, but it's that one is sort of off my playlist. I cannot anymore. And I realized, like, I don't want to risk that, because there's other songs that are deeply comforting and soothing to me that I can live without them for 6 months. I don't want to live them without them for the rest of my life.
That makes sense.
I do that. I make a sense. It doesn't mean I'm right. It's just that I'm good at rationalizing things. So another thing that you said, that I spoke with an acquaintance of yours, Simon Drew, in depth about this. So we don't need to go too deep, but I always like asking different people similar questions to see where you go with it. You talked about using philosophy in a more modern setting so as to build character and have a better quality of life. I'm paraphrasing. Who gets to decide?
Decide what?
What is character? What is quality?
Right. Oh, that's a great question. I believe in, I guess, what you might call moral intuition. I certainly don't lodge moral judgment with God, or again, with hearkening back to what we were speaking about earlier, with an ism, with an organized belief system. But I believe that we know inside when we're pointed toward the, for lack of a better word, toward the good, and when we're not. And I think that the sign that we're going in the right direction is a sense of tranquility, because there is a congruence between our thoughts, our words, and our deeds. And so we're safe to be our unvarnished selves, to, let me think about this a little bit. I realize I'm veering a little bit away from your question. Let me back up for a second. I believe that You know, you often hear the expression, you have this one precious life. Okay, fair is fair. But I think in a way we live two simultaneous lives. And one is our outward curated self, our presentational self, the version of ourselves that labors to be intelligible to the people we interact with, and sometimes to be liked, or, you know, to execute a transaction with someone of some kind. But I think along with that, there's our other life, our inner life, our, maybe you call it the aspirational life. I don't know. I'm just thinking this out loud. But I think we have in us a sense of inbuilt destiny, or an acquaintance with the better parts of our nature that want to actually infuse or get along with our outside presentational self. I'm not being fair to you. I need to come back to your question. Who decides? I think we do. Now, I know that that then begs the question, like, well, Hitler probably thought he was just a straight up great guy, and he probably thought that his idea of goodness was the one that we should go with. I don't know what to say to that. All I know is that in my own life, my own efforts to always be checking in with, to use that boring word, my values, what my highest values are, my moral values, my aesthetic values, my practical values, my spiritual values, not to give them a name and put them into little compartments, but to know what I'm pointing my compass towards. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. However, having worked in a prison with literal serial killers and serial offenders and one-offs, single murderers, single offenders, it's difficult. Like, I had the opportunity to work closely with people who did horrific things, and it was frequently difficult, if not impossible, to know, even if I asked, is your behavior externally congruent with your internal values? In other words, are you kind of a dick? Are you? Is that really kind of just what you are? Because some people have to be. Like, I don't believe that humans are inherently good or bad. I believe that we do the best we can with what we're given and with what we're taught. And what we're given isn't necessarily fair, depending on, you know, your socioeconomic status and the range of capacity you have. You know, the best possible cartwheel I can turn is terrible because I can't turn one, right? So, like, I'm given this range of potential cartwheels I can turn, and it turns out the range is real narrow and they all suck. And expand that out to speaking or engaging with other people or conducting yourself through the world in a morally and socially ideal way, or at least harm reductionist sort of way, a non-harmful approach. Some people just don't have that ability. Other people fully do and make the choice to hurt other people. And I often struggled with the question of, does that matter? Does it?
But can I stop you for a second? What is that? What does that look like?
This is what I'm saying, is that ultimately they look the same. I don't know if it matters.
They look
because, like, if someone else is dead because you killed them, they're dead. And whether you never had a good chance in life and you had a number of brain injuries and you have a substance addiction and you have a history of abuse and all of the bad things that can accumulate to make life very difficult and create difficulty navigating the world in a pro-social way, or you're raised by pro-social parents who took time to learn who and what you are and brought you to events of your choosing, you know, taught you the instruments of your choosing or the sport of your choice or whatever it may be, and just treated you well or the best that they were able. And you just decided, yeah, no, I'm going to kill somebody. That's a thing that I'm going to do. Either way, someone's dead. Either you lost control and you didn't have much control to begin with, or you let go of control, regardless of how much you had, and somebody ends up dead. Right. So does it really matter internally whether you are inherently a good person, whether humans are inherently good, or does it matter more what the impact of your behavior is on the world around you?
I to me, it matters to point myself in the direction of being, I don't know if I would say the best person I could be, but a fully expressed version of myself, because I think that effort, that ongoing, never-ending effort, I think it upgrades what you might just call the social ecology, and it's a counterweight against meaninglessness, because all of us, every day we wake up and look around ourselves, there is no obvious meaning of, I mean, life is absurd. It's there's no absolute, true, apparent reason that we're alive. I mean, there may be one, or there may be a bunch, and we just don't know about them. But in order to not just be sort of bags of meat hurling through space and just reproducing and making other bags of meat hurling through space, we need to make meaning, or we need to find meaning, or sometimes, if we're really lucky, by Jiminy, meaning finds us. And so I have found it's just a useful way for me to organize my life, to recurrently remember what I deem to be most precious, and then to the best of my ability to just place a bet on meaningfulness and act as if and go all in.
And that's a dangerous weapon, right? Because if you are a responsible weapon holder, you're careful where you point it, and you're careful to make sure that it is in good repair, and where it is aimed and how it is aimed. And if it is misfired, as it were, then you figure out how to fix it before you cause more damage. But there are other people who feel fully justified in harming others.
Yeah.
And they think that's fine. Like, they don't have any problem with it. Like, one of my children has a trauma history. My youngest, my adopted kid, has a trauma history. And she's too young to be formally diagnosed as such. But I'm seeing signs of sociopathy, of a lack of empathy and a lack of sonder and a lack of awareness that she lacks these things.
Yeah.
And there are times where she says or does things that if you ask her, why don't we do that thing? Why don't we pull the cat's tail?
Yeah.
She can stop and she can think and she can say, because it hurts the cat. And that's not nice to do. So she knows an answer. It's there. But left to her own devices, she might do it anyway. If she feels that it's going to meet some, for her, greater need. You know, in her concept of what is good and not good, it's very different from my other children's concepts of what is good and not good. And what is, like, she doesn't understand safe and not safe and things like that. And it's this whole way of existing in the world that I was aware of on a professional level, but I was also privileged to be able to go home at the end of the night and get a break. And now living with it and seeing her struggle all the time, because she doesn't want to get in trouble and she doesn't actually want to hurt people. That's not her goal. It's that she can't predict what seems obvious to others of us, you know, calling someone names or taking an item that belongs to someone else at school or invading someone's personal space. When asked, she can follow you through the mental exercise of, hey, let's not do that anymore and here's why. But on her own, she's more focused on, okay, yeah, but I want something else. And this is a child who was traumatized for the first 2 years of her life and then has spent the past 7.5 years in a, hopefully, healthy and safe environment. You know, the best that we are able to give her. And yet those first 2 years got their hooks into her and have formed who and what she is in the world. And then I extrapolate that to people that I worked with in the prison who reached their 20s without ever having someone look at them and say, hey, that's not okay, don't do that. Or, hey, you matter, you're important, you're safe here, or whatever, that, you know, both negative reaction to negative behavior and positive reaction to positive behavior. Like, that just doesn't happen to people. And a great number of people that I worked with, more men than women, I worked mostly in the men's prison. And so the majority of the men that I worked with would say to me, I didn't mean to hurt anybody until they were hurt. Like, it never occurred to me, you know, they would talk about like theft as a victimless crime. And I'm like, okay, but it's super not. You get that, right? You know, and they would eventually get it, sort of, kind of, sometimes. But other times they'd be like, yeah, but it's just money and I needed it and they didn't, so I took it. And they would extrapolate that to higher, you know, interpersonal crimes and crimes of violence and the like. And, you know, I wanted to get laid that night. And she said no, but, like, she'd said yes before, so it was fine, I figured. And I'm like, okay, but you're in prison, right? Like, that's not a coincidence that you're in prison because right. of the rape that you perpetuated, you know? So maybe we need to dig a little bit deeper into the concepts of how your behavior might impact other people. And these were people that you really would see this light bulb moment of, oh, so I shouldn't punch someone else when I'm angry. And you wouldn't think that a 20 or 30 year old man would need to have that thought process. But I mean, we have a criminal justice system. Clearly, there's a need for a degree of that. And a lot of people did not wake up that morning and say, I'm going to commit a crime.
Yeah.
They just woke up that morning. And so the concept of, like, imbuing meaning into things, there are some who never had any comparative meaning to help structure their world from childhood into adulthood. And, you know, and I would ask, you know, we do a terrible job in our country in terms of, you know, and I would argue many countries, but I know a lot about this one, about preparing for reentry into society after being released. Mm-hmm. And I would ask, what's something you're looking forward to doing? And I had more than one person say, I don't have anything I'm looking forward to. I don't know what that means. I don't understand the question.
Yeah. Oh, man.
And so that, do you see what I'm saying? Like, where it becomes,
I do this, see what you're saying.
This dangerous weapon of, if you are in, if intent is the weapon that is in the hands of someone who has a basis of meaning and has an intention to not hurt other people and generally not be a dick, then I get it. I follow that, you know, there's some gray area here and there, but by and large, you can hand people their own compass and let them follow it. But I wonder more about either people who don't have a compass in the first place or whose compass is broken in the first place and then you know, lately, the way things have gone politically in the U.S., I'm like, collectively, our compass is broken. And so who gets Indeed. To decide?
Well, you know, as you're speaking, Kate, I'm starting to think that this business of meaning making and meaning finding, meaning seeking, that it's a luxury, that it really is a luxury.
I don't know if it's a luxury because I think it's necessary, but I don't think it's a natural skill or an inherent, you know, congenital skill for a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, I think it needs to be prioritized. It cannot, we don't live in a time, if we ever have, where we can treat it as a luxury. But right now, there's this hope that people will figure it out. And I don't think I'm a deeply hopeful person in that sense. I tend to run fairly cynical, and I tend to be more about, let's assume that people need to be told things. Because I would rather irritate you by setting boundaries that you already knew about than get hurt or hurt you by not drawing the boundaries and then overstepping.
How were you changed in your thinking about morality and ethics from your work in the prisons? Did you go in kind of an innocent, and then after you were in that black box and came out the other end, you were different? Or, well, I'll let you talk. What was that like?
I didn't go in an innocent, but I think I went in with, I'm certain that I went in with assumptions. And for one, I believed that we collectively, the criminal justice system and psychology as a field, understood choice and behavior in a different way. I believed that behavior was more volitional than it actually is.
Hmm.
That I think the concept of the bad guy doing bad things made sense to me, that they did bad things because they chose to do bad things. And some do. That is a true thing, that some of the people that are in there knew what they were doing, knew of the potential outcomes, and made their decision anyway. Some didn't have choice because they didn't have adequate self-control, and others would have made different choices if they'd been given different training. So they didn't have a choice because they didn't understand their own autonomy, sort of.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, leaning into certain cultural mores about, you know, machismo, for instance, or capitalism as being these intense values, and having never been told, you know, there's another way to function through life where you get your basic needs met without looking like the biggest, strongest, scariest guy in the room and without having the biggest bank account.
Yeah.
And this came as a legitimate shock to some people. We explained to them that, like, you know, I don't respect you more when you're scary. I respect you more when I know that you want to be scary and you are able to control it. And you could watch the little puff of smoke happen because their brain just burst into flames a little bit, you know? And I mean, I've always been prone toward cynicism. A story I've told on my show before, and I think it bears repeating, is that I think that more the majority of people who are in prison are there because the judicial process was followed correctly. We do have false confessions and wrongful convictions in every prison in the country, but the majority, the larger percentage, are people who did what they were accused of doing and were found guilty through appropriate use of our criminal justice system. But that doesn't mean still that they were bad guys. And also, there's a certain tendency, and I don't know whether I don't know at what point this eroded, but the story that I tell is that it's easy to forget that. It's easy to look at somebody who's wearing an orange jumpsuit and who is literally handcuffed to the chair that they're sitting in when they talk to me, and to forget that they're a human being. Mm-hmm. And early on, when I started at the prison, they gave me, you know, you give the new guy the easy tasks, right? And so my task was to fill out an intake form. It was like a front and back 2-page form.
Yeah.
The theory being, let's find out, do they have any history of certain diagnoses? Because it's super common for somebody to walk into mental health or medical services and say, oh, I forgot to tell you guys, I have terrible ADHD. I need Adderall. Because there's just as much of a drug trade inside prison as there is on the outside, and arguably more so. And so we at least would try to sort of scoop them up as they first came in. And there's a certain logic to that, except they've already been to jail. You go to jail first, pre-trial, and then if your sentence is longer than about 5 years, then you go to prison. So you've already been trained by the other inmates on what to say and not to say. So it's kind of an empty exercise, but fine. It gave me a thing to do. And I think more than anything, it was about teaching me to be used to being alone in the room with convicted felons. And one of my first inmates that I worked with, we'll call him Joe, was approximately the size of a Mack truck. Like, I'm in my, you know, late 20s, and he was just this just huge, just, he had to duck, and in my memory, he had to like both duck and sort of scoot to the side to get through a doorway, like, because he was so tall and so broad, and this, you know, body fat percent of, you know, single digits, like, this is, he had been in prison more than not, and he took working out as his vocation and perhaps religion. And that's intimidating. And I was doing the intakes in this unused classroom. So I basically had a desk, like an old picture 70s style teacher's desk that I was sitting at writing. And he had like the crappy waiting room plastic chairs with the sort of bendy aluminum legs and semi-arm rests that they had. And the armrests had all been broken off. And I learned why later. And that's because for certain inmates, they walk in their handcuffs with their hands behind their backs. And my job, I learned, was to tell them immediately, don't sit facing forward in the chair. Rotate 90 degrees so that the back of the chair is along one of your sides. Because if you are sitting leaning up against the back of the chair, every time you move, the handcuffs ratchet a little bit tighter and you lose circulation to your hands. So if you sit sideways, then it won't hurt as much, right? But I don't know that. All I know is that this guy's walking in, I'm sitting in a room full of crappy furniture, and the first thing they do is they bring him in and they handcuff him with a, you know, it's a slightly longer, it's not the handcuffs that connect your wrists sort of to each other, but one end is on your wrist, and then it's about a foot long chain, and then the other side of the handcuff. And so he walks in with one, like a fashion statement, like a bracelet, and they slap the other one around the leg of the chair and have him sit down. And I'm like, you just turned the chair into a weapon. Like, what are we doing? Like, this guy is not, like, this is not going to slow him down one bit if he decides he wants out. Yeah. But okay, I guess we're going to cope with this. And he had been in prison more than not as an adult. He'd been in and out many times. And so he knew the drill better than I did. You know, if anything, he was training me. And we go through the papers and I ask him the questions, and some of them he's answering before I've asked. And I'm like, slow down. Like, let me pretend to be a professional here, please, sir. And we get to the end of it. And one of the things that I had learned through grad school that I carried through my work, both in the prison and then later I did crisis work in the emergency room, was to say out loud to myself on the drive to and from, this is an honor. This is a privilege, what I'm doing. Who gets to see this, right? Everybody thinks they know what happens behind locked doors, but I'm actually there. And these people don't have to talk to me. I can't reach in and pull the words out of their brain and stick them on the paper. Like, they have to speak words to me. And they're trusting me in some form to do so. And so I made a point of acknowledging that both to myself during my commute, but also to them when we were done talking. And so when we were done with this guy, who was one of my first inmates that I had spoken to, I finish, I fill it out, I sign the form, I set it to the side, and I'm like, okay, I think we're all set. Joe, thank you for your time. I appreciate it. And Joe, who is the size of a Mack truck and just built like a brick shit house, whatever that means, that's what he was built like, burst into tears, like ugly crying. And I'm looking around. It's only the two of us in the room. And I'm looking around for somebody to rescue me because I just broke Joe. What did I do? Oh, my God. What did I do? What just happened? And I'm just sort of, I can't even, like, literally, you know, I'm like, do you want me to go find tissues? Knowing that I'm going to have to wipe his nose and his eyes for him because he's handcuffed. And so I'm like, I literally don't know what to do right now, Joe. Like, and he's like, you have to stop saying that. And I'm like, tell me what so that I can stop saying it. He's like, sorry, I've been in prison for a total of, I think, approximately 18 years of my adult life all together. My family doesn't talk to me anymore. I don't have friends. Inmates refer to each other either by last name or by nickname. And corrections officers refer to them by number. So you're not even a name anymore. And so he's like, I haven't heard someone call me by name in 20 years. And I wasn't ready. I didn't know how to cope with that. And it still stays with me. It still hit me about, like, this is how far we are willing to go to dehumanize these people. And then we have the audacity to act surprised when they reoffend, when we spend years treating them not even like humans or like animals. We treat them like numbers, like inanimate objects, and we don't let them even have a name. And then, you know, talk about the facilities and the grossness of it and all of that. And then we kick them out onto the street, and we have the audacity to be surprised when they break another law. Like, unbelievable. And that was a moment of realizing that this guy's objectively terrifying to look at. And he had done some big, scary things, but there's still a human in there.
Yes.
And that moment created a sea change in my assumptions about the nature of humanity, about who's a good guy and who's not a good guy, and what's a good thing to do and what's not a good thing to do, and how do we make this better, and does it make sense? Like, should we, you know, up until that point, I had never really questioned the length of our sentences and the harshness of the surroundings, because smart people came up with this. And then I realized, oh, no, it's not smart people, it's politicians that came up with this. That's different. It's politicians like to sell prisons. It's sexy to sell, you know, war on crime, war on drugs. And the reality is, no, you're declaring war on your own citizens, and your citizens are going to fight back. So that's a lot how it changed, is this ability to see nuance and the ability to find both sides of a person, because you have to remember, I worked with people who would refuse to ask inmates what their crimes were, or would refuse to review their dockets and their paperwork, because they were like, I just want to know who they are as a person, without any preconceived notions. And I'm like, your preconceived notion is the fact that he's in prison. Like, you like, that doesn't mean he's a bad guy or a good guy, but you should know that he's had a rough life. You don't just wake up one day and be like, wait, how am I in prison? Like, it's a process. The criminal justice system is a process, and it's a long one. And it's my responsibility to know what this person was accused of. That doesn't mean I necessarily believe the accusations, but it's important for me to know what they expect me to assume about them before I walk into the room. Both so I can call them on their bullshit when they try and test me on it, and so that I can also tell them, you know what, I believe you, when they don't expect to be believed.
That's a beautiful and telling story. One of the things that I took away from your experience is how important it is for all of us, in prison, not in prison, any walk of life, there is an impulse of, we need to feel like we matter. It's such a simple thing, but it's foundational. To be treated like a cipher is, it seems like, even worse than someone actively trying to hurt you.
Yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. Yeah. It's most of the guards I worked with were decent guys.
Yeah.
They meant well. They weren't deliberately abusive. And this is a, you know, talk about a power differential kind of relationship. Like, you can't get much more visibly different than when you have one guy wearing a cop uniform and the other guy wearing prison overalls, right? Like we know who's in charge here. But most of them didn't abuse that power, or they didn't intend to. But at the same time, they are doing a fundamentally inhumane thing every day. Their job is to keep another human being inside a concrete box. And that's a tough one to reconcile and to sort of forgive yourself for and to live with. And so I think referring to the inmates by number was self-protective for the guards.
Mm.
Because it's easier to put numbers into a box than it is to put people. And it's tough, you know, and yet at the same time, I think, well, then here's a radical idea. Let's put fewer people in the box. What do you say?
I vote for you to run the zoo.
Oh, I'm so tired. No, I already have kids. I don't want to be in charge of anything ever again. But yeah, no, you know, it's that. Look, the way we've been doing things, maybe it worked once upon a time. Maybe. That's a big if, but okay, maybe. But it's not working now.
Yeah. Have you ever seen someone, I don't know, someone, say, who was in the prison system, have a total transformation or redemption? I'm not even sure. I'm kind of casting about for the right words. But have you ever seen someone turn, do a 180 in their lives?
I'll answer a question with a question. Do you have a guess on, or an assumption, or whatever it may be, about what type of offender, what type of offense people are more likely or less likely to repeat? Like, do you have a sense that there are certain proclivities that are more deeply ingrained as opposed to other proclivities, or were aren't proclivities at all, but were just sort of the result of circumstances?
Right. Well, I certainly can't defend this, but if I'm honest with myself, I would say reflexively, I thought of people, men who rape.
And that's, thank you, good. That's actually among the lowest recidivism rates out of inmates.
Is that right?
And the reason is that there is a subcategory of rapists and sexually violent predators who are setting out to hurt other people sexually. That is a true thing, and those people are dangerous, and they actively seek out opportunities to reoffend. But the vast majority of people that we consider sex offenders, the people that you can look up on your local neighborhood registry, They don't understand what legal consent means.
Huh.
They really believe you can't rape your wife. They didn't understand the statutory limitations around age. They didn't understand that, we'll go with, for simplicity's sake, we'll say he and her, right?
Okay.
That he didn't realize that the fact that she was asleep makes it rape. That she can't consent if she's asleep. She can't consent if she's intoxicated. She can't, even if she said yes 6 hours ago, that doesn't apply to now. And it's awkward asking for consent. I agree. But you know, if you're willing to do the thing, it seems like let's learn how to say the words of the thing that you want to do. And teaching, therapy within doesn't exist on the inside the way that it does on the outside. It cannot. It would be unsafe and unethical to do the kind, what we think of as therapy on the outside. Because yeah. If you think about it, like a good therapy session, you walk out tired, mentally tired, as though you're the way that your body feels after a good workout, but for the brain, right? And you feel a little vulnerable and a little shaky. And a lot of people go home and take a nap. And that all, that's how it should be. Like if it was easy to just fix ourselves, then why would anybody go to therapy? In prison, that would be endangering the safety and potentially life of an inmate. If I were to break them down to a vulnerable and emotionally shaky position and then be like, okay, 50 minutes is up. Go ahead and walk across the rec yard now. See ya. They'll get their ass kicked before the door has closed behind them.
Yeah.
Because yeah. you learn to be, I mean, the best profilers in the world are predators. And, you know, because they know how to find a good victim.
Yeah.
And we collect predators all in one place inside a prison. And so it would be unethical to carry out one-on-one therapy in that way. And so forensic psychology means doing a lot of assessment, and there's a fair amount of education, psychoeducation that happens. And one of them, you know, so anger management, impulse control, and they word it in different ways, but effectively it's sex ed
mm-hmm.
for people about what is and is not healthy. Where do your sex drives come from? What can and can you not control? Is pornography realistic ever? No. The answer is no. By the way, just putting this out there in the world, like that's no one is ever gonna walk into an office and be like, I'm gonna fix your copier and the woman's gonna get naked on the copier. That's not a thing.
Right.
It's just not.
Yes.
You know, but in our culture, that's valued, that's created, like these violence during sex, abrupt sex, rough sex without prior consent. These are all concepts that we don't talk through with kids and we don't talk through with young
that's
adults.
Fine.
And then they end up in prison for it. And arguably, like I said, there should be consequences. But they can attend these sort of sex ed classes, and the vast majority of the time, you're not talking about sex, you're talking about consent,
mm-hmm.
and you're talking about the laws and the rules of the state that they're going to live in after they're released. And it doesn't take very many sessions for that light bulb moment to happen, for them to go, oh, so if she's sober and I ask, can I do this? And she says, yes, that's what consent means. I'm like, yeah. What if she says nothing? Then it's no. What if she's drunk? Then it's no. Oh, then that's clear. I get it. Okay. How come nobody ever taught me this? And I'm like, because we suck as a society. And I'm so sorry that no one ever told you this before, because we do a disservice to our children in how we educate them. But yeah, it's not easy. But it's not complicated. And so the vast majority of the people that we think of as sex offenders who end up on a sex offender registry, often for life, with their picture, with their home address, sometimes with contact information, with limitations on where they can and cannot live, where they can and cannot work, for the rest of their lives. Doesn't matter the length of their sentence or whether they ever have parole. They can still end up on that sex offender registry forever, and they don't need it.
You've given me an education.
That's the kind of thing that we absorb. You talk about the zeitgeist of society. I think those are one of the things, the idea of, you know, pedophiles we think of as people. We, in our culture, we don't know the difference between a pedophile and a pederast. So a pedophile is attracted to children. A pederast acts upon them. Mm. Pedophiles can function safely in society, some, without acting on their urges. Being inherently attracted to a thing doesn't mean that you are overwhelmed by an impossible impulse to touch it. There are people willing, who are adults, who are willing to indulge in age play. There are dolls. There are fantasies that they can indulge in. There are chemical and physical procedures they can pursue. And I know of people who do, because they are so afraid that they will offend. Mm-hmm. But we don't like to think about that. That's uncomfortable to think about pedophilia as a concept. So instead, we put them all in the same category. All pedophiles are terrible, terrible, horrible people, and should be locked away forever. And that's so simplistic, and I find that dangerous.
Amen.
So yeah, it's a lot of things like that where it's like, you talk about the education, and we talked about the zeitgeist. This sort of all brings us back around to, or very early on in our conversation, you talked about in the 90s, there was this swinging of the pendulum toward sort of Eastern ways of thought and religions and values and concepts. And you used the word specifically mindfulness. And that's one where the philosophy of mindfulness and the psychology of it overlap in really interesting ways. Because mindfulness has a role in therapy and in psychology, and including in some really difficult to treat experiences for people.
Do you mean trauma? Are you alluding to trauma?
Trauma to borderline personality disorder, to certain illegal sexual proclivities, to overcoming substance abuse, addiction. There are ways in which tenets of mindfulness have been combined and included and integrated into current practice in ways that I wouldn't have thought of before. You know, once upon a time, I thought Freud knew what he was talking about. And I still get mad whenever I stumble upon the happily rare time when I agree with him, because I really hate agreeing with a snotty, misogynistic old white man. But once in a while, he did have some good ideas. But, you know, once upon a time, like, old white men were what formed psychology. And it was right around the time where there were more women entering the field. And also, we started mixing and matching. So it didn't have to be all one school of thought discreetly from another one.
Yes.
And that we started pulling from mindfulness and from meditation and from, you know, just different ways of using techniques that work in other parts of the world and have for thousands of years. And it turns out that Americans don't hold the monopoly on rightness.
Surprise!
Magical. And so I just I loved coming back to that, you know, it was interesting when I talked to Simon. He's going for a purist stoic mindset. That is his goal. And I poked him a little bit, because he tolerated me, and I appreciate that very greatly, because I pushed a little in terms of words, in terms of what do you mean when you say this, and what if I mean something different when I say it. Are we both wrong? Are neither of us wrong? How do we go? You know, and we really kind of dug down into the meanings of things. But ultimately, he is striving toward a purity of approach. My sense.
I think that's fair to say.
And I acknowledge and respect that, but I can't think that way. I can't think from only one school of thought about almost anything.
I think it's a man thing. Not to be overly reductionistic, but in parallel with what you're describing is thankfully happening in the psychology field, where women are starting, not just starting, but are part of the conversation and active contributors to the structure of the field and to its tenets, and this idea of not thinking in unitary ways, you know, this is the right thing, this is the ideal, you know, monoliths. Now, some people will say, well, you know, if you just cherry pick stuff, that ends up becoming self-serving and even pandering. But I think we have to always be learning, listening and learning. And I think I'm kind of improvising here, but I think the fundamental question that life always puts to us is, so what are you going to do with this moment? This moment right here, because it's the only thing over which we have sovereignty. And if you believe in some monolithic set of ideas, you can't be present to this moment. You can't hear its music. You can't learn. You can't change. This moment is the pivot point. And we always have the option. We can pull the trigger of the gun. We could hug somebody. We could put down that drink and never drink alcohol again because it's messed with our life. When we become aware of that power of this right now, oops, it passed. This right now, oops, it passed. But right now, the seed can be planted for something good, something choice worthy, something that augments and hopefully by degrees radiates into the future.
Right. And I think that using that analogy, some of the strongest cultivars are hybrid plants.
Ding, 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 ding. Yep.
I don't fully know which aspect of this to latch onto strongest, because they're all important. The concepts of mindfulness, the concepts of quality of life, tranquility, whether humans are fundamentally good, like those are all really important things. And if you're not spending time thinking about it, please do. Please spend some time thinking about it, because it matters. How humans are fundamentally matters. So Sharon, thank you so much for your patience and for talking with me. You're fantastic. And I really enjoyed thinking about thinking. Thank you guys for listening. I'm back as best as I can be. It's going to take me a while to catch up and to be myself again, whatever that means, but I'm trying. I'm still dealing with some medical stuff, but I'm trying. I will be back as soon as I am able. I don't know what that means. I don't know when that means. But hang in there with me, okay? Because I have some amazing conversations saved up, and they're important and they're worthwhile. So Until then, be good to you. Be good maybe to each other. Give it a try. It's worth it. Because you matter.